Welcome to The Filibuster, the podcast of the Union University Political Science Department. The Senate filibusters the right to unlimited debate. This means that senators could speak nonstop with the hope of changing fellow senators' minds and or reaching or persuading a broader audience. Because of this, some call the Senate the world's greatest deliberative body. We're going to be a little bit different from the Senate, though, because we're going to place a limit on our discussion while also being a form of civil debate and discussing things from our academic, political, and Christian science perspectives. My name is Sean Evans. I'm the host today, and we are welcoming Seth Brake, who is our international relations professor, to help us understand a little bit more about what's going on in Venezuela. Welcome, Seth.
Thank you so much.
Sure. So give us the brief 411 of what has been going on the past week and any kind of introductory kind of information we need to understand
this. Well, if you are listening to this, then you probably already know, at least if you're listening to this in a timely fashion, you've probably seen nothing but the fact that, so we'll start with the most arresting and interesting part of this, and that is that the United States has kidnapped the president of Venezuela. We can then look a little bit backwards. So there was a buildup of military assets in the Caribbean around Venezuela for months. It began to get more serious as the U.S. began targeting and attacking boats that were coming out of Venezuela that the U.S. alleges were used to smuggle drugs. And then it all culminated in a raid that happened Saturday morning, I believe. See, the time's blurring together now.
Yes.
But early Saturday morning, around midnight, was when it started. The United States did a four-hour attack on Venezuela that included ground troops, so it is a small invasion, where the United States bombed several targets, mostly anti-air positions. Well, actually, before it all started, the power to Caracas, the capital city, was turned off, including whatever was making the some of their equipment and radars operate, the things that you would use to target aircraft. So their anti-aircraft capability was somehow deactivated in a cyber attack, and then multiple sites were hit with strikes, and then a group of Army Special Forces soldiers entered Venezuela, entered the president's compound, abducted the president, and took him back to New York to stand trial.
All right, and just so we are clear on this, President Maduro was indicted in federal court in 2020, and I think also in this past year also.
Yes, and these are federal charges, basically accusing him of drug crimes. And maybe that's the best place to start here, because what's most interesting about this is who you would normally identify as a foreign head of state, right? But we are handling this as a domestic legal issue.
Okay, so when I think of this, the closest comparison I have is when George H.W. Bush invaded Panama to extradite, I'm putting those in air quotes, since you can't hear me, Manuel Noriega to Florida to stand trial for drug crimes. Is this the same thing, then?
The main difference is just the scale of what it represents. I mean, Venezuela has been a sovereign state, an important one with international allies and networks and all that. It's one that the U.S. could not touch for the longest time, and we have been trying. We've had sanctions against Venezuela. We have had pressure for years, and things have just been getting worse and worse for that relationship. And what's so dramatic about this is that just overnight there is a important foreign leader who is just gone. And so, yes, I mean, legally there's some comparison. In terms of scale, this is really something new.
Okay, so let's talk about this. Is this legal?
According to who, right? I mean, yeah, we are members of the United Nations. We're not supposed to invade other UN members. So in the most basic sense, in that it is a foreign, it did involve a small invasion. That is illegal under international law. But under domestic law, things are a lot more complicated because we did not pursue this as a matter of foreign policy. As far as I know, Trump has not yet invoked the War Powers Act. This is not a
But then even if we look at the War Powers Act, all you have to do is inform within 48 hours, and then Congress is supposed to vote if it's ongoing after, what is it, 60 days?
60 days, yeah.
In which case it's moot.
Right. So, we could go that direction, but the Trump administration has been at pains to be clear that this is a domestic political legal issue, and we consider this domestic law enforcement.
domestic law enforcement in another nation.
That's right. Now, you know, he was arrested in another nation, but he's being brought here. He was read his rights. He has now attorneys representing him in court. He's not a prisoner of war in the eyes of the United States, although he considers himself to be a prisoner of war, and that was his opening statement in court. He said, I consider myself to be a prisoner of war here, not someone charged with a crime. So, yeah.
Well, that's not going to work too well for him, more likely than not, in a U.S. court
No, process. But he's in a confusing situation. I mean, one moment you are the president of a powerful country in South America, and the next moment you're in court in New York. This is unusual.
It is unusual for that. So, does this potentially set good or bad precedents going in and seizing a foreign leader?
You know, this is an area where I'm not sure precedent even matters as a framework anymore. We're in new uncharted waters, and I don't even know what the precedent for this would be. The precedent is that the United States might be able to sometimes get you. The only precedent that matters here, I think, is in capability. In that the United States was able to extract him so quickly and so effectively without losing any soldiers. It's a demonstration of strength. This is something that I'm not sure anyone thought that the United States was even capable of before this.
Well, okay, do you mean we're not capable of? We do have the best military in the world.
And that was on display.
So capabilities would not be an issue. Do you mean something else by capabilities?
No, I mean actual capabilities. The fact that this was done without any casualties.
Any American casualties.
That's true. There were something like 70 people killed.
75 Cubans.
Yeah. 32 Cubans, I think.
Close to 32 Cubans. Okay. Yeah.
And that gets into another issue we can discuss, because the international involvement and different actors there is a really complicated web. But I think the speed at which it happened and the untouchability of the U.S. forces, I think, is something that we did not expect was possible, actually.
Okay.
I do think this was a paradigm shift.
Okay, so we're looking at this as a law enforcement action. Mm-hmm. Do we think this is going to actually reduce the amount of drugs coming into the U.S.?
So this is where things get complicated, because the actual justifications for the abduction of Maduro under the drug dealing charges is kind of flimsy. I mean, yes, there were drugs coming out of Venezuela, but the idea that there was this cartel called the Cartel of the Suns, and that he was the head of it, we don't actually have that much information about that, and I'm not sure what evidence is going to be presented in court there. So in terms of the drug issue, it's probably not going to have much of an effect on anything, but I don't think that's the actual purpose of what happened here. And this is where maybe I'm going to break with what the Trump administration
says.
Good.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, but what is the purpose? I know that Secretary Hegseth, I won't use his crude explanation for it, but he said, mess with us and find out what happens.
Yes. A major rival of the U.S. and the Americas has just been removed from office in a very dramatic way. The message is heard loud and clear throughout Latin America that opponents of the United States are in a unique kind of danger right now. But it's not just in Latin America. That's the message that's heard in Latin America, and we can talk about it. It has very different audiences in different parts of the world. So in Latin America, it's you're in the U.S.'s backyard and you need to comply. But internationally, it's we're now going more directly against the sanction evasion network that exists than we have ever done before. This is a very dramatic form of sanctions enforcement that we're doing here as well.
Okay, so let's take these in turn. Let's first talk about from the Latin American perspective.
Sure.
I think from a lot of Latin American countries, what they're probably seeing with this is colonialism redux.
Yeah, I mean, what if you want to put it in the terms that the Trump administration is using, they've rehabilitated and reactivated the Monroe Doctrine. They are very actively making the case that countries that are aligned with U.S. enemies in Latin America are going to face extreme and direct pressure from the U.S. government in ways that we haven't done before. In the National Security Priorities document that the government put out a couple months ago, they called this the Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, but now Trump has taken his own phrasing on it, and he's calling it the Donroe Doctrine, which is just this idea that we are going to be extremely active and intrusive in Latin America when countries are opposed to us.
Oh, okay, so why isn't this colonialism in the sense of
he's
talking about all of the oil
yes.
that we're going to get from Venezuela, sell it, and then distribute it as we see fit.
Well, this is the part that gets weird as well, because we are getting different messages are being given to different constituencies. So I think J.D. Vance was on TV yesterday being interviewed, and he was asked, you know, why are we going to Venezuela? And he basically said, because we want to take their stuff, is what he told his Fox News audience.
Well, that's also what Trump has been saying on social media and on
But on, you'll note that we don't currently have any of their stuff. We have one guy. And then we have been putting pressure on the government to sell their oil on the international market instead of the black market. And then I believe the current proposals that are being being thrown around, and again, this is going to change by the day, right? But the current proposals are that this oil will be sold, and then the proceeds will be held and then given to the Venezuelan people back when they have a legitimate government or something like that.
Okay, well, the stuff that I've read implies that it will be sold, it will be put into an account, and that Trump will decide how it is spent.
Well, and that's the more realistic part. Yeah.
On behalf of the Venezuelan people.
And this is how the U.S. conducts regime change. I mean, we hold the money until we like the government, right? This is not... They're using an old playbook here. Like, this is how we've approached Iran and some other sanctioned seizure type stuff. And these aren't new tools, but what's new is the level of discretion that Trump wants to have over it, and also the way that it's being sold. I think that the Trump base is made up of people who are very skeptical of regime change. They're very skeptical of foreign intervention, things like that. And so the administration has to be very careful how they sell this to their base, because Trump is the non-regime change, non-interventionist guy. He needs to be able to communicate that this regime change is different, and so this time we're just doing it to steal stuff. That's his messaging.
And that's going to be something different, because, I mean, look back to what was going on with the Gulf War. Opponents said, we want Iraq's oil. So it's the same thing then.
Well, it's a little bit different now. It's the opposite.
Well, it's the same reasoning.
It's a funhouse mirror.
Well, that's one way of looking at it.
In the past, we might have wanted to steal the resources and lied about it. Now we don't want to steal the resources, but we're lying to say that we do. It's a reverse foreign policy approach, because what's really happening here is we're trying to choke off Russian oil markets. We're trying to Venezuela was one of Russia's partners in creating this oil black market that was able to sell off these resources, evade sanctions, things like that. One of the ways you can tell that this was the goal is, what do we do immediately after kidnapping Maduro? We start chasing down oil tankers.
Well, in fact, we stopped a Russian oil tanker recently with a Russian submarine nearby.
Well, it was originally flying under the flag of Guyana, I think, and then they changed halfway through the voyage. They got permission from the Russian government to switch to the Russian flag. But this was part of what they call the dark fleet, or the shadow fleet, or the ghost fleet. Some people are talking about the gray fleet. There's any number of names for this loose organization of ships that allow Russia and its allies to evade sanctions. And Venezuela was a large part of this, and this ship was part of that network. And we're tracking it down and shutting down that network in direct opposition to these countries. And I think this is what makes this so unique. We go after Maduro directly. We invade his country, kidnap him, bring him back. Now, this is a Russian flagged ship that the Russian government has said is under their protection, and they're sending out submarines to protect it, and we just seize it. We got there before the Russian submarine, so we did not have the Atlantic showdown people were worried about, but the fact remains, we are being much more aggressive and activist right now on every front, and this is why now Trump, it was hours before we recorded this, and so when you hear this, you'll know the details of this. I don't know what's going on, but Trump says that if Iran starts killing people, we will bomb Iran. He was very clear that we will take violent action against Iran if they start killing protesters, and he said this like 30 minutes before the first reports of soldiers opening fire in Iran. So who knows what's going to happen with that, but something has changed in the last few days, and the Trump administration has gone directly adversarial toward, in every direction, toward all of our rivals. And
Let's hold off on that for a second with this. Okay, so though we're in the international realm, the idea is, okay, we're trying to stop Russia from avoiding sanctions.
Yeah.
To what end?
Well, I mean, I can speculate. I can speculate that the United States is trying to bring an end to the war in Ukraine right now, and sanctions pressure is one of the main tools that we have for bringing Russia to the table. So I imagine that that trying to shut down the ways that Russia avoids sanctions is part of bringing trying to bring Russia to the table in Ukraine. I could speculate about other reasons, but the main thing is that we're at this point where pressure on Russia is good for what the president wants, and it's good for, and it's consistent with past administrations' approaches as well.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about the about this situation before we get to Iran. Okay, so they have removed Maduro, but the Maduro organization still runs the country.
Oh, sure, the party still runs the country, yeah.
So are they cooperating, and how long can we expect this to occur?
Well, when the new president was sworn in, Delcy, I believe her name is, she originally said she would not be cooperating with the United States. And gave a speech saying that Maduro is still the president and, you know, they're going to stand up to invaders. And then she received a series of very direct threats from the U.S. government and the president. The president said that he will do to her worse than they did to Maduro, which I believe is probably a death threat. I mean, I don't know how else to interpret that. And now we have some indications of cooperation, but the point is the game has changed a little bit. And one really important thing that's changed is, obviously, in the last 4 years, Russian power has gone down dramatically. As an opponent to the United States and an ally of Cuba, Venezuela could be expected to be a Russian ally, and they could expect Russian protection.
Okay.
The Russians are out. They're down. They're weaker. And they were in fact, this is another. I'm sorry. I'm over there for a second. There were representatives from the Chinese government in Caracas meeting with Maduro the day before he was abducted. What's happening is Venezuela is still trying to maintain its role in part of the anti-U.S. coalition, and the rules have just changed under them. So Russia can no longer protect them. We've demonstrated that China can't protect them, and apparently we don't even care about Russian military pressure because we snatched that ship out from under the Russian Navy.
Well, and you would imagine that Putin doesn't really want to get into a shooting match with the U.S.
Clearly not,
It doesn't do anything in his idea. But the idea of what you're saying then is he's trying to expel all our adversaries from the Western Hemisphere to make this a American hemisphere.
Well, and that is
a United States hemisphere.
And that is consistent with the strategy document they released in November, so yeah.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about this. Some people said that the next domino they want to fall is Cuba.
Yeah, sure. That is almost certainly the next thing that the United States wants to happen. And, you know, one of the figures we haven't mentioned yet who really is the architect behind all this is Marco Rubio. Regime change in Cuba has been a priority of Rubio's for a long time. Also in Venezuela. He has been advocating for direct action against Venezuela and Cuba for as long as he's been on the national stage, and it looks like he's been given the keys to the kingdom for at least a few weeks, and he's making hay while the sun shines.
Right, so and the part of the reason why he is doing that is because he is a descendant of Cubans who fled when Castro take over, and there's also a large Venezuelan expat community in Florida, and that explains it. So is this part... So is this something that Rubio's been pushing for and that now he wants to cut off oil to the successors of the Castro regime so that it falls?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to assume what's going on inside of Rubio's head and his motivations, but we do know that he has always been on the hawkish side of U.S. foreign policy, and he's been on the activist side for foreign policy for the United States, and he has a unique focus on the Caribbean. So, yes, this operation has Rubio's fingerprints all over it. You'll notice that when foreign governments feel threatened by the United States now, they're calling Rubio, not Trump. This is something that is happening, for example, with what's going on. We haven't even mentioned the Greenland situation.
I'm getting there. Hold
but
on.
Rubio's running point on that as well.
Yeah.
He is U.S. foreign policy right now, it seems like.
So it seems then, is this really about putting pressure on Russia? Is it about Rubio trying to advance something he's been trying to get for decades? Or is it even Stephen Miller, who's also played a large role in this? Because now, if the Maduro regime is gone, then there's a whole lot of Venezuelans who have migrated here, where their asylum issue is no longer real, in which case that could lead him to support the deportation of more people out of the country, because that's been his big hobby horse for about the past 20 years.
In terms of Miller, I don't think the political realities in any of these countries are keeping him from advocating for deporting people. So,
No. Legally,
yeah. Oh, sure.
If the Maduro regime is out, and the new regime is cooperative, that and in the fact that they've also released a bunch of political prisoners kind of undermines the asylum argument, which makes it easier legally for the deportations to occur.
That was mentioned in the strategy document, that they see political instability in Latin America as part of the cause of our current immigration problems. So if we could just get those countries more stable, we wouldn't have as many asylum seekers, things like that. So there is something to that. I'm not discounting it, but I don't think that Miller is calling the shots in U.S. foreign policy right now. I think this is a Rubio game.
Okay, so what then is Rubio playing that three-dimensional chess where he is thinking about making this our hemisphere and putting pressure on Russia to end the war in Ukraine, or does he have other ideas? Because remember, Rubio was elected as a neocon.
That's right. And this is the reason why I don't think that we can read this entirely in the framework of Trump's foreign policy or even this national security document, because we are now looking at Iran, which doesn't fit that pattern at all. We wouldn't care about a regime change in Iran very much if our main goal was dominating this hemisphere and getting out of Europe. So there's probably more going on here.
Well, but or are they doing more things than one?
At
the same time. And the other thing is with Trump is he's moved by his emotions and guts.
Yes.
And he's a fidget who always has to be doing something with no attention span, which means he goes from here to here to here to here. I mean, he was also launching missiles into Nigeria.
That's right.
Was it last week?
Yeah.
And now threatening
more over the
this.
Time,
so
yeah,
is
sure.
this with Trump? I kind of find it hard to think that there's a coherent strategy.
Well, this is an under-discussed part of Trump foreign policy, is the degree to which he's guided by a strange, precise empathy, in that you get his emotions activated about a foreign policy issue, and then you'll get 2 weeks of his attention. You know, and I can't always predict or explain how that's going to line up, but what I do think is that not only is Trump's attention drift from issue to issue, but also who's in his favored circle, right? And I think Rubio has earned himself a lot of flexibility because of how well this raid went and how much power Trump got out of it and how much good press he got out of it. And so he has let Rubio off the chain for a few weeks. And sometimes when you have that kind of power, you do as much of it as you can before Trump then remembers that maybe J.D. Vance can have a turn or something.
Okay, so let's talk about making this the American hemisphere.
Sure.
Is this a move toward regionalism?
There are many people in the Trump administration, and I think whoever were the architects of this national security strategy would want it to be. But,
yeah, I mean, yeah. I think that was written by the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Policy. I'm blanking on his name.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't recall off the top of my head either. But the you would think that it was, except for the next moves we're making. And so it would be consistent with a regionalist approach. It would be consistent with what, in the history of American foreign policy, we call isolationist eras, when we mostly try and do our foreign activity in Latin and South America. The U.S. is never fully isolationist, right?
Right.
But the reason I hesitate on this is because of how much this ends up focusing on Europe and the Middle East. We are the same people who conducted the raid with Maduro are on their way to the Middle East right now, from what I understand. It might just be a lightning round of the policy priorities of a certain faction or clique in Trump's government getting their way, and it's the more activist side. So it could lead to more regionalism, but I'm not certain right now.
But even that you're basically telling me is that there's no strategic planning in the Trump White House. It's all a game of musical chairs, mm-hmm. and whoever Trump hasn't pulled out the chair from.
Well, okay, that is true to an extent. There is another angle on this, though. It could be, we got to remember that Trump's diplomatic strategy is highly personal, right?
Right. It's personal and transactional.
That's right. It could be that we need to look at this through that framework and understand that Trump now feels like he's on top of the world, and his most capable administrators are getting things done for him, and so now he's looking at the world and rethinking who his friends are going to be. He's not acting anymore like he thinks he can be buddies with Vladimir Putin, for example. You don't start seizing tankers if you think that's possible. He is acting like he is going to get a new set of friends out of this because he has impressed everyone with how well he abducted Maduro. It could be that he's just reshuffling his international friends list as well.
And who are his new friends?
Well, we're going to see who emerges to lead Venezuela, right? But I think a good model for thinking about what the ideal Latin American country for Trump would be is looking at El Salvador, where Bukele in El Salvador is a controversial president, but what he has done is he's endeared himself to the Trump presidency by providing a service to the U.S. government, and that is internment, right? They have these large prisons, and those prisons can house deportees, right? It's like people who are deported from the United States can be thrown into El Salvadorian prison, and they'll take them. So what El Salvador has done is a personal relationship between the president of El Salvador and the president of the United States has provided the U.S. with a convenient way to deport people who we don't have anywhere else to send them. And I think that's the type of thing that Latin American countries who want to get on Trump's good list are going to start doing. So right now, Venezuela might become a place that offers the U.S. system oil with which they can buy other things like, say, Greenland.
So basically then what you're saying is if you do what Trump wants, you can oppress the heck out of your...
Sure.
Country.
Yeah, well, it is true that Trump doesn't really care that much about democracy, right?
He
is,
or human rights, as far as that goes.
Probably not. Yeah. Now, I don't want to sit here and say that I understand exactly the state of civil liberties in El Salvador right now. I know that the crackdown was bad and they suspended civil liberties in a lot of ways, but I also know that some of those emergency things have been reversed, things like that. So, I don't know. I don't want to speak that confidently,
sure,
saying that we don't care about those things. However, it is the case that I think Trump will get along very well with any Latin American leader that offers a very specific service and a friendly embrace to Trump personally.
Okay, so let me get back to this regionalism,
yeah, sure,
and this colonialism. On one level, the connection between Latin America and Greenland, which he's saying is part of the Western Hemisphere, mm-hmm, i.e. our sphere,
that's right,
is resources. Or natural
resources.
Well,
he's changed
resources.
His tune on that with Greenland. He now has been saying in interviews that there are no resources Greenland has that the U.S. needs anymore. He says we have better resources than the continental United States. He said this very specifically, saying we have no need for Greenland's resources. We very specifically need them for their proximity to Russia and for some monitoring stations or something like that. He's trying to emphasize national security reasons. Part of that is because for legal reasons, it allows him more leeway to operate. But also, I think he thinks that this could actually happen now that he could acquire Greenland, and he's being very precise and careful with his language because he needs to package this in a way that's not going to make Denmark pull the fire alarm. Now, that's not working. They are pulling the fire alarm, right? But this is I think he's dropped off the resource language for Greenland for that reason, because now it's not just rhetoric. He actually thinks he's going to get it.
I've seen no movement that he's going to get it, though.
I think we're in a different world after the Maduro abduction, and I think we're in a world where Trump now thinks he can get it, and he's... did you notice who he dispatched to go negotiate for Greenland? He's sending Marco Rubio. He thinks this is his guy who gets stuff done. This guy got him Maduro. Maybe this guy will get him Greenland.
But you can only make a deal if the other side wants to deal.
Mm-hmm.
And the simple fact is Denmark doesn't want to deal, and he's getting a lot of pressure from even Republicans in Congress,
yes,
that you can't seize Greenland.
And this is why his lower level officials have been correcting him, not actually correcting him, but every time the idea comes out of seizing it, they say, well, actually we're planning to buy it. And this is because...
But there's no indication Denmark will sell. And there's no indication
I want to be careful.
Greenland wants to become part of
I want
to
be
US.
Careful how I phrase this, because okay. I'm not advocating for this. I'm not defending this. I'm not saying Trump's right. But I think the perspective of the administration is that after the Maduro incident, we are in a different political reality. And that... that there is a wider range of options on the table. I think that he feels respected, he feels feared, and he thinks he's going to get something new.
Okay, I can see that, but I'm not sure one action is a world-altering event. And so think in that, and maybe I'm mistaken in this, but I don't really think how seizing one small dictator mm-hmm. has changed global politics in a measurable way for the long term.
Well, it may be that you're right about the facts, but I'm talking about the perception of the Trump administration, and I do think they're acting like something's different.
But does that mean other people will act like it's different?
We will find out.
Okay. We've talked about the regionalism idea. Another idea that maybe China and Russia are saying, hey, we're moving toward a great powers world mm-hmm. where powers have spheres of influence.
Yeah. So this is the world that Russia wants, right? This is the mm-hmm. world they've been trying to create with blood in Ukraine, a world where there is an area that they can do whatever they want and the rest of the world can do whatever they want. And there was a lot of fear when this Maduro incident first happened that this might be Trump kind of de facto accepting that reality by saying, okay, we'll beat up our friends, you beat up your friends, whatever. But again, the immediate turn has been scaling up and challenging. So I'm not sure that that's what's happening anymore. It did look for a second like we were going in that direction, but I think that we see an emboldened Trump who now wants victories over all of his enemies, including those in Russia. That's what it looks like to me right now. And again, it's this confrontation over the tanker that really reframed everything, because we are shutting down Russia's black market on oil. And or at least trying to. We're not, obviously, this is two out of hundreds of ships, right? But it was direct, and it was done directly over the complaints of the Russian government. They said the ship was under our protection, don't touch it, and then we just took it.
So basically, Trump thinks everything's going his way.
That's right.
So I'm thinking of Greek tragedies and the idea of hubris.
Yeah, well, hubris might be a good way to describe it, because he does think he can do anything right now. Another thing that...
I mean, yeah. and so, I mean, you're talking about this, and that makes me concerned when people with great power think they can do mm-hmm. anything.
Sure. It's a legitimate concern, and I hope that there are people in his circle who can talk to him right now, but it would be hard when you have someone who's so pleased with themselves. One encouraging note is that the tanker was seized with the cooperation of the UK government, and... they provided the intelligence to seize the thing, and they now have the tanker. It's now at a UK port. So Trump is still working with European allies, at least in some way. I don't know.
Okay. So are there any other international implications we haven't talked about?
I mean, the main one is Russia has been made to look very weak here. This is good news for Ukraine's bargaining position when both countries look like they're ready to try and end the war. This is probably good for that. The other thing that we need to watch right now is what's going on in Iran. And again, by the time people are listening to this, the situation on the ground is going to be different. When we're recording this, which is on Friday, or no, Thursday. Today's Thursday.
Yes.
I don't even know what day it is anymore. Yeah, we're on Thursday right now, and there are very large demonstrations going on throughout Iran. And, of course, this has happened before, and the regime has been successful at putting them down. But what's different this time is that there's some cross-national stuff going on. There is some activity across the Iraq border, things like that. So, and after Iran is weaker than last time we had something like this, because they had recently lost a short war with Israel, and mm-hmm. they have fewer international proxies. So the people of Iran are opposing the government directly in the streets. They're fighting with the government right now through the night. So this is a moment where the Iranian regime looks weaker, and Trump has promised to use violence against them by the morning. So we'll see.
So are we going to kidnap the Ayatollah then?
Here's what I would... My understanding is that we can't do that, is that that's too difficult. But I would have probably said that about kidnapping Maduro too, so I don't know what tricks we have, but no, I don't think we can do that.
Well, okay, so here's the lesson, I guess, from the Iraq war is that getting rid of your opponent is easy. What happens next is hard.
Well, yeah, if you care about regime change, right?
Well, but yes, I mean, yeah. Isn't that what we're kind of saying he's done in Venezuela?
So,
and
I,
then
I actually,
if we add this, if he drops some bombs in Iran, does he stop? Because the idea is if he stops and the regime doesn't fall, then all this great things, I'm great, I'm powerful, I'm strong, I'm respected, is gone.
Yeah, I want to say first that we have not accomplished regime change in Venezuela. We have removed the leader.
We've removed the
but
leader,
the party
right.
is still in charge, right. and his vice president took over, and the system is still operative, right? And this is really important, actually, because part of what justified, part of what made this a safe target for the U.S. is that the opposition in Venezuela has been recognized by most of the Western powers in the world as being the legitimate leadership of Venezuela. Not so the president has been declared illegitimate. Maduro was declared illegitimate because he lost the election.
Right.
And the opposition leader was given the Nobel Prize. Right. So we gave.
But yet we're not turning over the government.
And this
to
is the
them.
And this is the thing. We don't have the power to do that.
Right.
We don't, and we don't have the will to do that. And Trump doesn't care because he wants somebody who he can work with. What the Nobel Prize and the international recognition and all that did was made Maduro an acceptable target, but it didn't give us the ability or the will to actually move on that. Now, and I think this is this gets into this Trump-style foreign policy. He doesn't want regime change in Venezuela. He wants alignment change from Venezuela. He doesn't care what type of government they have. He needs a government that is aligned with U.S. interests. Or at the very least, his. He would settle for just Trump.
So the idea then is he trying to send a signal to people in Iran that you can remain in power if you get rid of the Ayatollah?
And that's
then
exactly
you
right.
Be the, but even with that, who can do that? The Revolutionary Guard is very tied to the Ayatollah.
And I have no idea if we have any realistic plan toward Iran. I think a lot of this is that Trump, he watches TV, right? He has been moved by the same images that everyone has, in that he says, oh, something big's going on here, I need to be involved.
But does he need to be involved?
According to his national security strategy document, no, he does not need to be involved.
Right.
But according to the bravado of the Trump administration post-abduction of Maduro, maybe he does. Maybe he thinks that this is something big going on in the world. I need my fingers in it. I don't know.
All right. So this has gone on a while, and we want people to not turn off on us. But let's kind of close with this. As Christians, how should we think about what the Trump administration has done in terms of international policy, international law, and how we should think about global politics moving forward.
There is a temptation that hits every successful U.S. administration, and that is this temptation to think that we govern the affairs of the world and the affairs of men, right? It is God that sets up and tears down governments, and the hubris that you were mentioned earlier, I think, is the real danger here for the Trump administration right now, too, in that you think you get a success, and you think, now I am the one who can enact, who can bring about success, I can recreate paradise, I can set right the wrongs of the world, when the Christian perspective would tell us that, now, it is our duty to try and love our neighbor, to try and pursue peace, to try and fix all these things. However, it is not our duty to replace God in governing the affairs of men, and that's the danger. It's walking that tightrope of doing good but not deifying yourself, not building the Tower of Babel, right? It's that's the tightrope, and I'm not sure that Trump is capable of walking that tightrope right now. But who knows? I mean, I don't want to say that he's definitely going to make all these errors, but historically we've seen him make this kind of mistake in the past. become so full of himself, thinking he can do anything. I think that's what led to his downfall in the first attempt at re-election, is thinking that he is the source of this power, right? That you saw that go to his head a little bit on January 6th, where he really thought that he could will his way back into office, or at least drag out time for the courts, right? I think we see that same mentality danger here, where Trump does not have the humility necessary to take a success sitting down. And that's the danger here. So as Christians, I think we need to recognize that we need to be humble in the face of God's movement as well. And what a Christian who is perhaps, I mean, even excited about things like the removal of Maduro or the weakening of Russian power or things like that, we should be giving thanks first and foremost to God for these things, and then responding in humility, saying, seeking the Lord and humbling ourselves before Him and asking that we might have continued blessings, not glorying in our greatness at achieving them. So that's what I would say from the Christian perspective. It's a dangerous place to be.
Right, and I think with leadership comes great responsibility, and due to the power that presidents have, I think it just reminds me of the importance of the character of the people who hold those offices.
No, that is absolutely
that
correct.
They do not abuse
because,
their power.
I mean, think about what's coming next now. We didn't have a showdown with the Russian Navy in the Atlantic, but we very well could have, right? Are we looking at a situation where Trump or anybody, or Marco Rubio or whoever, becomes so excited about their trajectory and confident in themselves, or, you know, the other temptation we fall into as Christians is saying, well, God is behind me, He endorses all my actions, therefore I can step forward, and, you know, you blunder into World War III or something. This is the danger that proper humility should help us to avoid, and as Christians we should be praying that our leaders are able to find. So what Christians need to be doing right now is, and, you know, get out of this podcast and pray for the president.
Okay.
Pray for his wisdom and for him to understand that blessings come from God.
All right. Any final thoughts?
I don't think I can top that.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, then I will thank you for giving us your insights on Venezuela, and I yield back the balance of my time.